This is the Humanist Report with Mike Figueredo.
The Humanist Report podcast is funded by viewers like you through Patreon and PayPal. To support the show, visit patreon.com/humanistreport or become a member at humanistreport.com. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Humanist Report Podcast. My name is Mike Figueredo, and this is the 134th edition of the program. Today is Thursday, March 15th. And before we get into the news, I want to take a moment to thank all of our newest Patreon and PayPal contributors that signed up to support us over the last 2 weeks, and we have quite a bit. So we have Aaron Washington, Alexander Ryan Crosby, Amala, Andres Torres, Bern O'Malley, Brian Seltzer, Brian Tevd, Brian Miller, Crystal Colon, David Palladian, Donald Cunningham, Ellen Liang, Eric Gwynn, Federico Andrade, Gabrielle Colon, Jack Ungam, Jacob Mounts, Jeff Wilson, John Tamburo, and even Jordan Sheridan. We have Justin Diaz, Katie Kleba, Kelsey Davenport, Kenneth O'Dowd, Kira Book, Christoph Falkowski, Mahesh Patabiraman, Malicious, Michael Lauren, Michael Shands, Rosalind Wilford, Ryan Craig, SS, Essie Nelson, Sean Dannon, Stephanie C. Lehman, Stephen Crothers, Stephen Moore, Tarek Lyons, Tony Bjorklund, Ulysses R. Galvez, Victor Horner, and Ruria A. Hodges. We also have Linda Sharp, Elizabeth Luna, Felix Weibig, and Mark Avalon, who contributed to our GoFundMe, but sent those donations in to us via PayPal. So thank you so much to all of those kind individuals. If you'd also like to support the show, you can visit humanistreport.com/support or check out patreon.com/humanistreport. And if you did submit a donation to our GoFundMe cause to build the new studio, then I will be thanking you in a separate video that is in addition to this episode that I'm filming now. Now, on the subject of the new studio, this is not our final new studio. In fact, the studio is about 65% complete. It's right there. So I'm in the room that we'll be filming in permanently, but I'm kind of boxing myself into a corner. So I have a lot less space now because I don't want to reveal, you know, the studio yet, because then that'd ruin the whole surprise. But for now, this is a nice temporary workspace that will give us time to complete the studio. Will it be done in time for the next episode? That's the big question. And it's one that I don't, unfortunately, have the answer to just yet. But know that we made a ton of progress last week, and I'm going to work really hard to get it done, and I can only work as fast as my brain allows. And I'm saying that because there's a lot of new equipment and technology that I'm not familiar with that I'm having to learn how to use. So I don't want to film in the new studio. Well, I mean, I don't want to film with the new studio and all the tech that we have until I feel comfortable using it. I mean, inevitably, there's going to be technical difficulties. Something will probably not work appropriately. But that's just, you know, there's going to be growing pains. But until I feel a little bit more confident, I want to make sure that we have this temporary space, at least to get the news out to you. So thank you all for your patience. Thank you to everyone that donated to us. Again, I'll be thanking each of those individuals in a different video. But for now, let's go ahead and get into the news that's really important this week. We have quite a bit. So Trump fired Rex Tillerson, and I'll tell you about his new Secretary of State nominee, Mike Pompeo, and why he's exponentially worse. We'll also talk about Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana, who pretended to be on the fence when it comes to net neutrality, only to introduce a bill that is one of the most harmful yet. Also, Bernie Sanders calls out Republicans and their plan to deregulate Wall Street. Elizabeth Warren tells us if she's going to run in 2020. We'll talk about Rachel Maddow's reaction to the idea of diplomacy with North Korea and juxtapose that with her reaction to the idea of diplomacy with Cuba. We'll also talk about Betsy DeVos's cringeworthy interview where she argues that defunding education will lead to better outcomes. Hillary Clinton still can't let 2016 go. Also, Senate Republicans propose a bill to legalize discrimination against LGBT people. Here we go. So, we are officially living in the weirdest time ever in American politics because when Donald Trump initially tapped former ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson to be his Secretary of State, Well, if you would have told me back then that I would now be disappointed that he was fired, I would have called you crazy, but that's exactly where we are. Donald Trump officially fired Rex Tillerson, and yeah, I'm a little disappointed, and I'm not disappointed because I like Rex Tillerson. In fact, I think he's a bad person whose company wrecked the planet, and he only got the job because his company contributed to Donald Trump, thus he was hired as a direct result of this corruption. But with the number of neoconservative lunatics influencing Donald Trump's foreign policy decisions, Rex Tillerson was widely seen as a moderating force in his administration. Not only did Rex Tillerson surprisingly try to influence Donald Trump to stay in the Paris Climate Accord, but he also tried to convince Donald Trump to not completely do away with the Iran nuclear deal. And additionally, he was one of the more reasonable voices with respect to Trump's stance on North Korea. So the fact that Rex Tillerson is now gone is actually really worrying, because Donald Trump has effectively purged all the reasonable moderating voices from his administration, and now what are we left with? Neocons. And I'm particularly disappointed in the ousting of Rex Tillerson when you look at who Donald Trump is replacing him with.
I wish Rex Tillerson well. Gina, by the way, who I know very well, who I've worked very closely, will be the first woman director of the CIA. She is an outstanding person who also I have gotten to know very well. So I've gotten to know a lot of people very well over the last year. And I'm really at a point where we're getting very close to having the cabinet and other things that I want. But I think Mike Pompeo will be a truly great Secretary of State. I have total confidence in him. And as far as Rex Tillerson is concerned, I very much appreciate his commitment and his service, and I wish him well.
So as you heard it there, Mike Pompeo will be most likely replacing Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, and Gina Haspel will be taking over Mike Pompeo's job as Director of the CIA. Now, both of these people have to be approved by the Senate in order to actually serve, and it's probably the case that Gina Haspel is going to face an uphill battle if Democrats have any fight left in them whatsoever, because she is a literal war criminal who oversaw a secret prison where Bush's administration tortured detainees, and she also destroyed evidence of their war crimes by destroying a video of detainees being waterboarded. So Gina Haspel is someone who should be in prison right now for crimes against humanity and for violating international law, but instead she is possibly going to be receiving a cushy new job from President Donald Trump. Unreal. Now, Mike Pompeo is someone who may actually be worse than Gina Haspel just because he'll have a lot of sway over Donald Trump's foreign policy, and he is, in fact, a neoconservative of the highest order, and he's also a terrible human being in general, and there are several reasons why we should worry about him becoming the next Secretary of State. So first of all, he thinks that Edward Snowden, a hero, should be killed. Literally. He said, quote, "He should be brought back from Russia and given due process, and I think that the proper outcome would be that he would be given a death sentence, all for leaking classified documents and exposing our own government's abuse of power." He thinks Edward Snowden should be killed. And that's not all. So when it comes to the Iran nuclear deal, as CNBC reports, not only has Pompeo likened Iran to the Islamic State militant group, calling the country a thuggish police state in a speech in October, he has also promised to constrain Iran's investment environment and roll back its 2015 nuclear deal. Now, in the absence of the Iran nuclear deal, which is a diplomatic solution, what's going to happen? This opens the door to intervention. Neoconservatives in the Republican Party have been trying for decades now to get our country to invade Iran. And by tearing up the Iran nuclear deal, you make it that much more likely that war with Iran is a possibility. And with someone as hawkish as Mike Pompeo, we have a reason to really worry that that is his overall goal. Now, as the Washington Post reports, Pompeo has gained a reputation for more hawkish positions, not only about North Korea, but also other U.S. geopolitical rivals such as Iran and Russia. And he's previously also hinted at wanting to oust Kim Jong-un, saying, "As for the regime, I am hopeful we will find a way to separate that regime from this system. The North Korean people, I'm sure, are lovely people and would love to see him go." So he's calling for regime change. That's what he was doing there. He's hopeful that we can find a way to separate that regime from the system. He wants to get rid of Kim Jong-un. This is someone who Donald Trump is making Secretary of State right as Donald Trump is going to be meeting with Kim Jong-un. Now, Mike Pompeo also seems to be opposed to the idea of diplomacy, generally speaking, because as Harrits reports, he has also said that nuclear cooperation between Iran and North Korea was a real risk to the United States. So, with Rex Tillerson gone, who again was a more moderate voice in Trump's administration, now we can expect someone like Mike Pompeo to push Donald Trump in a more neoconservative, interventionist direction. And it's not like Donald Trump needed any help with that, because he already had neoconservatives doing everything they can to influence his decisions, and it's working. In fact, some are arguing that it's Mike Pompeo that actually influenced Donald Trump to initially put a lot of pressure on Kim Jong-un and saber-rattle against North Korea. It's Mike Pompeo who did that. So this is the guy who will be the Secretary of State. Things are getting really terrifying. Really terrifying. And this should give Democrats a reason to get their shit together. But if you look at Twitter, the leader of the so-called resistance, Chuck Schumer, is expressing hope that Mike Pompeo will actually do a good job. So that implies that he's going to go along with this and vote for Mike Pompeo. Chuck, you have the power to say no. You can vote against him. But he's giving us the indication that he's not even going to put up a fight a little bit. He's just going to allow Donald Trump to appoint whatever neocon he wants. You know, these things, in and of themselves, that Donald Trump is doing and the people he's appointing, you know, it'd be terrifying and problematic itself with an effective, strong, forceful opposition party. But the fact that we have an opposition party that's basically non-existent, that's willing to roll over and die at any minute and any time Donald Trump does anything, it just, it's a disastrous combination. So, not good. We all have to be hypersensitive to everything that Donald Trump does, because I thought that we would at least maybe get Donald Trump to back off of Iran since Mike Flynn was out, but now that Mike Pompeo is in as Secretary of State, I mean, now he's really in potentially a position to drive Trump's foreign policy in a really, really significant way. Republican Senator of Louisiana John Kennedy is an interesting figure when it comes to American politics, particularly with respect to the issue of net neutrality, because as we look for the 51st senator that will vote to nullify the FCC's repeal of net neutrality using the Congressional Review Act, well, in January, John Kennedy indicated that he might actually be an individual that might vote in our favor, signaling to us that he was on the fence, saying, quote, "There are a lot of nuances, and there are very good arguments on both sides. I'm honestly undecided. Right now, to me, it's a very close call." Okay, so I don't really understand how anyone can entertain this ridiculous idea that both sides have equally legitimate arguments, because one side, our side, we want to protect the internet by keeping it the exact way that it is now, and the other side wants to ruin the internet. So I don't get how you can try to be a fence sitter on an issue that's so clear, but nonetheless, if he's giving us any type of hint that he might be on our side and might be a potential ally, then we'll work with what we got. We'll accept you if you are going to vote to nullify the FCC's repeal of net neutrality. So even if I don't really understand his reasoning, nonetheless, he still gave proponents of net neutrality at least some hope that he might be one of the only Republican senators that was willing to do the right thing. However, he ultimately decided to go in the completely opposite direction, and he stabbed every single net neutrality activist in the country in the back by introducing a piece of legislation that is so harmful to the cause of net neutrality, it might be the worst bill proposed regarding net neutrality yet. And that's not hyperbolic, because according to a Medium post by Fight for the Future, Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana just betrayed his constituents, Louisiana small businesses, and millions of internet users by introducing legislation that essentially outlaws net neutrality while claiming to save it. His bill is a companion to telecom shill Marsha Blackburn's ridiculous, quote, Open Internet Preservation Act. This bill is not net neutrality. It's not even weak net neutrality or a compromise. It's a bill to kill net neutrality. It would legalize paid prioritization, opening the floodgates for internet service providers to charge new fees and discriminate between online content, kneecap the FCC's ability to prevent abuse from internet service provider monopolies, and prevent states from enacting their own net neutrality rules, like the one Washington just passed. He's trying to ban states from passing their own net neutrality legislation. Now understand that this is essentially doubling down on something that's already going to be in effect soon, because when Ajit Pai and other Republicans on the FCC voted to repeal net neutrality, there was a clause in that repeal order that preempted states. It blocked states from carrying out their own net neutrality laws. And since John Kennedy here probably sees that states like Washington and Oregon are moving towards protecting net neutrality legislatively, well, he's trying to double down and give them even another reason why they shouldn't do this, because it might be challenged in court, not only because of what the FCC did, but now because of this legislation in the event it were to be passed into law. Now, the oddest part about this whole story is that, quote, Senator Kennedy told Politico that he's still considering supporting the Congressional Review Act in addition to this terrible legislation that he introduced. That's a head-scratcher. And at face value, I can see why someone would think that his stance is confusing, because he's effectively, he's taking conflicting stances here, right? He's on both sides of the issue simultaneously, when those sides are diametrically opposed. So you can't be on two sides of this issue. You have to pick a side. And I don't think this is a head-scratcher at all. I think he's bullshitting us. What he's trying to do is basically throw bait to proponents of net neutrality to get us off of his scent, so that way he can turn around and pass legislation like this while basically trying to convince us that he might go along with our plan. I'm sorry, I don't buy it. If you are going this far to make sure that states can't protect net neutrality, you're not an ally, and I don't think there's going to be any chance that you're going to be an ally. So what he's done here is propose something that's even more harmful than Marsha Blackburn's bill. He's basically doing what the FCC did, but he's trying to codify that into law with this piece of legislation. So he's not a potential ally. He is now one of the most harmful senators in the country when it comes to net neutrality. And we have to treat him as that big of a threat, because he is. He's just bullshitting us. He's trying to gaslight you and make you think that he might get on board with the Congressional Review Act, when we know that that's not true. Because if you were going to get on board with the Congressional Review Act to nullify what the FCC did, why would you introduce legislation that basically reinforces what the FCC did? So here's what we need to do. We need to send a clear message to John Kennedy that we know where he stands now. He's made that crystal clear. And he's taken a stand against us. So you can tweet to him. His Twitter handle is @SenatorJohnKennedy. And let him know that you are outraged by the bill that he introduced that kills net neutrality. Additionally, his phone number is 202-224-4623. I'm going to call and let him know that I'm on to him.
Senator John Kennedy, we apologize that we're not able to answer the phone, but if you leave your name, number, and a brief message, we will get back to you. Thank you and have a good day.
Hi, John Kennedy. I just wanted to let you know that we net neutrality activists have been realizing that you've been a fence sitter now for quite some time, but you just introduced a piece of legislation to Congress that would ban states from protecting net neutrality. You did all this while claiming to not really know what side of the issue to get on. Additionally, you said that you're still considering joining onto the resolution to nullify the FCC's repeal of net neutrality under the Congressional Review Act. So it's clear that you're just trying to gaslight us and lie to us, because what you just did was propose legislation that bans net neutrality. So we're on to you. We know that you are lying to the American people. We know that what you're doing is the same thing that Ajit Pai did, except you're trying to make it permanent. You're trying to codify anti-net neutrality legislation into law. So understand that now you have officially made an enemy out of proponents of net neutrality. So if you're up for re-election, congratulations. We will primary you and we will beat you, because both Republicans and Democrats are in favor of net neutrality. And you're going against the overwhelming majority of the country here by proposing this type of telecom-friendly legislation. So you should absolutely be ashamed of yourself. And if I'm wrong, please prove me wrong. Vote to nullify the FCC's repeal of net neutrality. But unfortunately, I don't believe that you're going to do that, because you proposed this legislation. That's awful. You're banning states from passing their own net neutrality laws? I thought you were a small government Republican. What happened to federalism? Apparently, you don't agree with federalism. You agree with big government, because you think that the federal government should tell states that they don't have the right to protect net neutrality. Well, guess what? Regardless if this bill passes or not, we are going to protect net neutrality. Stop being a shill. Sorry, I wasn't expecting that, and I was going to rant for like 20 more minutes. But look, this is unacceptable. There's absolutely no excuse for John Kennedy. I mean, what makes it worse, really, is that he pretended that he was an ally. And then he goes and does this. Unreal. So, he's not an ally. That's clear. He made that very clear. He drew a line in the sand. So, he's not going to go along with the Congressional Review Act. If he does, then I'll be pleasantly surprised. But I don't expect it after he introduced this piece of legislation. Shame on you, John Kennedy. This is absolutely despicable, and you should be ashamed of yourself. Shilling for the telecom industry against your own constituents and the American people. Disgusting. Education Secretary billionaire Betsy decided to buy a job in Donald Trump's administration because, to her, you know, it wasn't enough to have billions upon billions of dollars and more money than one can ever spend in her lifetime. She felt like she needed to do something else to have a more fulfilling life. So as education secretary, and in buying that job, she thought if she could affect policy that applies to us peasants, and particularly cut funding of underperforming schools, thus exacerbating an already problematic situation, that would give her life some meaning. So in a CBS interview, she was actually asked about her disastrous policies that, quite frankly, are not working at all, particularly with respect to the state of Michigan. And to say that this interview was a disaster would be a gross understatement, because there was really no way to defend her policies, because she's promoted this idea of school choice, meaning that you're giving parents choice by funneling money to private religious schools and cutting education funding for public schools, that would really be the best option and increase choice. But in actuality, the result is already playing out, and it's a disaster. So she was asked to defend her position, and it didn't go so well. And this was probably one of the most cringeworthy interviews I've seen in months. Enjoy.
Why take money away from that school that's not working to bring them up to a level where they are, that school is working?
Well, we should be funding and investing in students, not in school buildings, not in institutions, not in systems.
And okay, but kids who are back at the school? It's not working. What about those kids?
Well, in places where there have been, where there is a lot of choice that's been introduced, Florida, for example, the studies show that when there's a large number of students that opt to go to a different school or different schools, the traditional public schools, actually, the results get better as well.
Now, has that happened in Michigan? We're in Michigan. This is your home state.
Michigan, yes. Well, there's lots of great options and choices for students here.
Have the public schools in Michigan gotten better?
I don't know. Overall, I can't say overall that they have all gotten better.
The whole state is not doing well.
Well, there are certainly lots of pockets where the students are doing well.
But your argument that if you take funds away, that the schools will get better is not working in Michigan, where you had a huge impact and influence over the direction of the school system here.
I hesitate to talk about all schools in general because schools are made up of individual students attending them.
The public schools here are doing worse than they did.
Michigan schools need to do better. There is no doubt about it.
Have you seen the really bad schools? Maybe try to figure out what they're doing?
I have not intentionally visited schools that are underperforming.
Maybe you should.
Maybe I should. Yes.
All right. So before we get to the substance, not that there was much there, but I just want to highlight the interviewer's face when she asked Betsy a question and she immediately started spouting off platitudes. That was just hilarious. Now, the interviewer is challenging her argument that school choice, i.e. promoting charter schools as a substitute to public education, it's just not working. We have empirical evidence from the state of Michigan that it's not working. In fact, it's a disaster. Defunding public schools does not improve the quality of public schools. Now, I could see how theoretically this might work because as parents opt to enroll their children in private schools more frequently, then classroom sizes in public schools might shrink, and that allows teachers to dedicate even more time to those students. However, this argument falls apart when you apply basic logic to it, because in the absence of adequate funding and resources, those teachers are still limited in their abilities to be effective educators. And overall, Betsy's argument collapses entirely when you see that what she's doing doesn't work. Defunding public schools and funneling that money to private, mostly religious schools is not working. And that's basically what the interviewer is trying to get across, that her policies are not working, and Betsy's argument is factually incorrect based on empirical evidence from the state of Michigan. But Betsy doesn't get it. She doesn't get it. She puts a big smile on her face and pretends as though, oh, well, you know, what I'm doing is just great, and I'm promoting school choice. You can call it school choice. You can call it education for everyone, but the name that you've given it is not an apt descriptor of what you're doing. You're defunding public education. You're fucking over students, Betsy. That's what you're doing. And not only is she wrong here, but she is choosing to be ignorant because she admitted here in this interview that she hasn't even visited schools that are underperforming. You haven't set foot in public schools, but at the same time, you're maintaining that you have the solution to all their problems. Cut their funding, give that money that we would otherwise be giving to public schools to private schools and charter schools and religious schools. It's just idiotic. I don't know how else to describe it. I'm trying not to be a dick to her, but there's really no way around it. She has no fucking clue what's going on. If you actually did visit one of these public schools, Betsy, do you know what they'd tell you? They'd probably say, we need more money. And that shouldn't be surprising, because it flies in the face of reason to think that less money would somehow yield better results. Who thinks that way? But Betsy isn't that stupid. I don't believe that she actually holds this stance. She knows what she's doing. Her goal is to make public schools so shitty that people won't have a choice but to enroll their students in charter schools, which is what she wants, is what she's always wanted. But these private schools are expensive, and not every family can afford them. In fact, most families can't afford them. So what's going to happen? You're just going to make public schools worse, and that's that. And if you only focus on charter schools, what's going to happen? The quality of education will decline for all of us peasants. But of course, that's what she wants. She doesn't want us peasants to obtain good educations, because then we might become aware of what she's doing that screw us over and the peasants might revolt. So you got to keep them dumb. And I love how she continuously pretends to be a champion of students, but under her tenure, she's punishing students. She's making it more difficult for college graduates to pay back their student loans. She is reducing the number of repayment plans. She's making it so we have to pay more per month. So, for example, under Obama's administration, you would only have to pay 10% maximum of your income. That's it. Only 10% could go to student loans. But they increase it under Trump's administration, perhaps under her guidance. This is the education secretary. So that's why this interview was so cringeworthy, because we're onto your bullshit. Nobody buys what you're selling, Betsy, but she pretends with a big smile on her face that everything's all peachy keen and that, you know, maybe she just has to pay a visit or two to one of these underperforming schools. But, you know, she'll come up with a solution. No, you won't. The solution is for you to resign, Betsy, because you don't know what you're doing at all. So I don't even have to tell you guys, but there are countless issues affecting the American people. We have a healthcare crisis. We have a student loan debt crisis. We have a climate catastrophe that is now imminent. I don't know where I'd begin if I were a United States senator. I don't know what I'd do first. There's a lot of issues that need to be dealt with. But certainly one thing I wouldn't focus on is identity politics. But one party has in fact chosen to focus on just that. And no, I'm not talking about the Democratic Party. I'm talking about the Republican Party, who still is choosing to focus on social issues instead of real substantive issues that would help people's lives. So the Republican Party, particularly Mike Lee and Raul Labrador, have decided to push for a bill that legalizes discrimination against gay people. As Matthew Rosa of Salon reports, on Thursday, Senator Mike Lee of Utah introduced the First Amendment Defense Act, a bill that, if passed, would make it legal for private individuals and businesses to discriminate against LGBT Americans by citing religious objections. It's a bill that was first introduced in 2015, and which both Lee and Raul Labrador said they planned on reintroducing as far back as early last year. The proposed law stipulates that the federal government cannot penalize through discriminatory action any individual who speaks or acts in accordance with a sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction that marriage is or should be recognized as a union of one man and one woman, or two individuals as recognized under federal law, or that sexual relationship outside of marriage are improper. Critics of this law are concerned that if passed, it would encourage businesses and other for-profit institutions to discriminate against the LGBT community or even heterosexual couples that have sex out of wedlock. So first and foremost, I don't know how this will be used to discriminate against heterosexual couples that are having sex out of wedlock, because how do you know whether or not a heterosexual couple is having sex out of wedlock to begin with? Are you going to ask every couple that comes into your business or place of employment? I mean, you can't do that. So really what this will be used for is to discriminate against members of the LGBT community. Now, will this be something that lasts, even if it is somehow codified into law? Absolutely not, because the country has moved on. We're no longer fixated on social issues. The country is becoming increasingly socially liberal, regardless if this backwards-ass party doesn't want to realize it. But we are. People don't care what other consenting adults do behind closed doors. They don't care because it doesn't affect their lives. And using religion as a justification for bigotry is not acceptable. We don't have to tolerate intolerance, and we won't. This is what they're choosing to focus on at a time when we have 8 different wars going on simultaneously, when income inequality is at record levels. This is what they're choosing to focus on. Now, the irony is that even if they are trying to name this after the First Amendment, calling it the First Amendment Defense Act, this is unconstitutional because it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So in the event this were challenged, it probably would be struck down, even though Donald Trump is appointing a lot of right-wing extremist judges. I mean, if they apply the law objectively and equally, this would not hold up. It wouldn't. Because it's brazenly unconstitutional. You're basically giving religious people a pass if they want to discriminate against members of the LGBT community. Look, this is a bill that will appease social injustice warriors or right-wing SJWs who are triggered at the thought of homosexuality, probably because they are gay themselves and just can't stand to see gay people because maybe they get turned on and it reminds them that, you know, they're not living the life that they want to live. I don't know. But what I do know is that it's time for Republicans and conservatives, generally speaking, to move on. I hate to break it to you guys, but you lost this culture war. You lost it. You lost. It's done. Stick a fork in it. It's done. Gay people are accepted. Generally speaking, even if there's still ignorance, Most people do not care that gay people exist. It's just you guys who are trying to appease an increasingly small portion of the country, evangelicals, that don't like gay people. Well, fuck off. I don't like you either, okay? That doesn't mean that I should be able to discriminate against right-wingers and evangelicals. I wouldn't do that just because it's immoral. But here they are trying to give right-wing evangelicals a free pass if they want to discriminate against gay people. So if I go into a restaurant, I have to worry that I'm going to get kicked out because I'm gay and I'm triggering these right-wing snowflakes. It's just, this is so stupid that we're talking about this in 2018. Move on! In an interview with Anderson Cooper on CNN, Bernie Sanders discussed Congress's latest attempt to deregulate the big banks and Wall Street. Now, let me remind you that this attempt is a bipartisan attempt to deregulate the biggest banks in the country. And if they actually are able to get this codified into law, then this allows banks to do what they did leading up to the 2008 crash. And of course, if we have another economic meltdown, who's going to be the one to foot the bill when these gigantic, too big to fail banks need to be bailed out? It's going to be us. We're going to have to do that. So Bernie Sanders discussed why he's opposed to this bill, and I wanted to share what he had to say because I think his insight is important, but there is something that I wanted to add.
I am strongly opposed to it. Why? What this legislation would do is deregulate 25 out of the largest 38 banks in this country. It amazes me how short memories are in the United States Congress. In 2007, 2008, this country was hurled into the worst economic downturn in the modern history of this country because of the greed and the recklessness and the illegal behavior of major financial institutions. And what's happened since the deregulation, since Dodd-Frank, I should say, is we have seen the largest banks become even larger. What the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, reported just the other day, as you'll recall, is they said this moves us closer to the likelihood of another bank failing. Why would we want to do that? Banks are now making, in general, they have made in the last 2 years, record-breaking profits. Yes, we want to help credit unions and small banks, but banks that are worth $200, $250 billion in assets, those are not small banks.
Do you think a collapse like we saw in 2008 could happen again?
Of course. I mean,
are there enough stopgaps in place?
But this is precisely what they're doing. They're removing some of those stopgaps. And according to the CBO, it will make it more likely that some of these banks may fail, leading to a massive taxpayer bailout. But let me ask you this. I got to ask you this. Is all over the country, there are issues on people's minds, you know, whether it's guns, immigration, health care. It amazes me that this is the issue that the Republican leadership has put on the floor of the Senate. And you know why? Last year, the financial institutions spent $200 million in lobbying. Over the last 20 or 30 years, they have spent billions of dollars on campaign contributions. This is the corruption. What you're seeing is the corruption of the American political system, big money rules. And again, one of the things that I am upset about is that this banking bill, this bill for big banks, is now on the floor of the Senate. We're not talking about guns. We're not talking about the DACA issue. Yeah. Got 1.8 million young people eligible for DACA. Some of them may start being deported soon. The American people don't want that. We're not talking about that.
So there's a lot there that's really important. So let's kind of take the time to deconstruct what he's saying. So first of all, he's saying what the CBO and pretty much everyone else is saying about this bill. If it's passed, this increases the likelihood that we will have another economic crash. And if that happens, we're going to be the ones to have to bail out the big banks. It's going to be our tax dollars that go towards that. And to me, I find that completely unacceptable because I want our tax dollars to fund healthcare and education. But unfortunately for all of us, our tax dollars are going towards death, destruction, and Wall Street. Subsidies for the oil and gas industry. Subsidies for financial institutions that continue to gamble with our money that we deposit in the banks. It's unacceptable. So I don't want our money to be used for these crooks, to bail out these crooks. And furthermore, Bernie Sanders implied here that this bill is kind of a distraction currently because there are a lot of issues in the country that aren't being addressed because Republicans are trying to deregulate Wall Street. I mean, we have DACA. That hasn't been sorted out yet. We have gun reform. That's an issue that needs to be addressed. But instead, what's the priority for Republicans? Deregulating Wall Street. And we just have to take a moment to reflect on how brazen the Republican Party is, because they've been in power now for more than a year, a little more than a year, but not that long overall. And what have they done? Policy after policy that they push for only serves the biggest financial institutions in the country, the richest oligarchs in the country. What have they given us that helps ordinary Americans? What have they done to help out the poor? They've done nothing because they don't care. Whenever they get in power, they try to shove through as much policies that deregulate and cut taxes for the wealthy as quickly as possible before they end up losing power again. That's all they're not even putting up this veneer that they give a fuck about Americans at all anymore. I mean, the mask is off. They are clearly the party of the rich. But unfortunately, Democrats have also revealed that they are the party of the rich as well, because they were in power. Obama was president for 8 years, 2 terms. And what did he do for us? Not very much. Is he better than Trump? Yes. But in terms of really going the distance and helping out the poorest Americans, overall, a lot more Americans are even worse off now, in large part due to some of the policies that Democrats pushed. So when Bernie Sanders talks about this bill, I really think that even though what he said during this interview was on point, he needed to emphasize that this bill couldn't even be possible at all if it weren't for Democrats that decided to go along with it. I mean, you have to call Democrats out because, yes, even though Republicans, they're the ones pushing this. I mean, they control the national agenda currently since they are in control of all three branches of government. However, if you have an opposition party that's not resisting the most harmful policies, then what good is that opposition party? We can't just focus on the party in power. We have to look at the opposition party and find out what's wrong, because certainly if we don't have an opposition party that's effective, that's willing to fight and push back against the harmful policies that this administration is pushing and this party is pushing, then we're really fucked. It's not just a matter of voting out Republicans. I mean, if we have a party in opposition that is pushing for this, then what's to stop them from doing the same thing if they take power? Nothing. And I don't like the way that this bill is being marketed, and Bernie Sanders talks about that. I mean, this bill is supposedly something that's supposed to help out small banks and credit unions, but that's not happening. We're being gaslighted in the same way we were told that Trump's tax plan would help out the poorest Americans and middle-class Americans, but when we actually looked at the numbers, when the CBO crunched the numbers and independent analyses were conducted, what did we find out? That if you are poor and middle class, if you make less than $75,000 per year, you actually get a tax increase over a decade. So that bill increased taxes on the middle class in order to pay for tax cuts that were permanent for wealthy oligarchs. And it was sold to us as a tax cut for the middle class, and even the media went along with that narrative. And here we are again, where we have this bill, this plan to deregulate Wall Street being sold to us as a plan that would be great for small banks and credit unions, when who's going to benefit the most? The biggest financial institutions in the country. Look, here's the thing. Too big to fail should not be a thing. If a bank is too big to fail, you break that bank up. Because we can't have financial institutions so big that our economy will hinge on them being responsible. They're not responsible. They're looking out for the interests of their shareholders. They're trying to increase profitability. It's pretty simple. So that the fact that you would deregulate them, remove fail safes, make it so that way they can do what they did in 2008, it makes no sense to me. So I am glad that Bernie Sanders is choosing to continuously speak out about this issue. And I am angry that this issue is taking focus away from the issues that are really important. We need to fix our crumbling infrastructure. We need a fix for DACA. Dreamers still don't have a solution. Their lives are still hanging in the balance. The state of politics in America, it's just it's so difficult to not be demoralized when you see the priorities of both parties. I mean, for Republicans to continuously propose things that screw over the middle class, and for Democrats to go along with it, 17 Democrats, 16 technically, but including Angus King, a Democratic Party-leaning independent, it's disgusting. So as you all know, Elizabeth Warren is currently up for re-election, and in an interview with Chuck Todd, she was asked whether or not, in the event she were to be re-elected, she would remain committed to her Senate seat, essentially asking her, are you going to run for president, or are you only running to be a senator for 2 years? And this is what she had to say in response.
So look, I am not running for president of the United States. I am running for the United States Senate, 2018, Massachusetts, woohoo. But let me actually make a underline a point on this one. And that is, we can't just be a party that says, oh, we're paying attention about what happens every 4 years. And I know there's a lot of anxiety, particularly on the Democratic side, about how we are going to deal with Donald Trump in 2020.
I take it as a no, you're not pledging to serve your full six-year term if you win re-election?
I already told you, I have no intention of running for the United States.
But you know, I don't mean to pick on you about this, but you know how many people have said that? You know how many people have said that over the years? 2 years before, and then, of course, have ended up running for president. You see why a lot of people aren't going to believe that answer.
Look, what I'm telling you is that I am in these fights every day for the people of Massachusetts and for the people across this country. Yeah. This government is working better and better and better for a thinner and thinner slice at the top. I am in these fights, and I am in this fight to retain my Senate seat in 2018. That's where I'm focused. That's where I'm going to stay focused. I'm not running for president.
So no pledge, though, on the 6 years.
I am not running for president.
So I think that her stance was pretty clear. She's not running for president, and I believe her. We have reason to believe her and to believe that she's not bluffing, because last time in 2015, actually as early as 2014 even, when she told us she wasn't running for president, she meant it, and she didn't run for president. And she made a really important point there. She said, we can't just be a party that says, oh, we're paying attention every 4 years. That is so incredibly important, because it's everyone. It's not just neoliberals. It's progressives too, myself included, that really become fixated on the next president. But we can't just focus on that. We have to focus on policy goals in between elections, even in between midterms. We have to make sure that we don't stop pushing for goals. So for example, if we get a Republican in the White House, that doesn't mean that we stop pushing for our progressive agenda and we wait 4 years to see if we get a Democrat in office. And I don't think that we have done that, but it's really difficult to not get focused and bogged down by talks of the next president, especially when we have someone as irrational and unstable as Donald Trump in the White House. I think, you know, I speak for a lot of people when I say we're counting down the days for this asshole to take a hike. We want him out of the White House. But with that being said, this point, you know, to not be a party that is only paying attention once every 4 years is really important. And it's a message that, you know, hopefully will resonate with everyone. But in terms of her running, I think that what she's doing now is she's clearing a path for Bernie. She sees someone who the momentum is clearly behind, and if she were to run, she probably acknowledges that she would split the progressive vote. But in choosing to not run, what's going to happen? All the progressive votes will be consolidated. Anyone who is progressive will vote for Bernie Sanders, and that will increase the likelihood that he'll win, and neoliberals and centrist Democrats will split their votes between all the other establishment candidates like Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Joe Kennedy even. I mean, these are a lot of options. So if we have just one progressive choice on our side, that's a benefit to us. But in the end, I do think that she is clearing a path for Bernie Sanders. However, what's interesting to me is that she wouldn't give Chuck Todd a pledge and say that she would remain committed to her seat for 6 years. So what does that tell me? Well, to me, that doesn't suggest that she is bluffing and that she really is going to run in 4 years or in 2 years. But what it does say to me is that she's open to potentially being a VP pick. If Bernie Sanders is the Democratic Party's nominee, would she turn down the chance to be his vice president? I don't think she would. I really don't. If there's some other establishment candidate that chooses to try to appeal to progressives, unlike what Hillary Clinton did in 2016, would she turn him or her down? I don't think so. So Elizabeth Warren, she's someone who, she's not dumb, and she is a very calculating politician, more so than a lot of us previously thought. So in choosing to not run for president, I think that's big. That shows us very clearly that there's another progressive contender that is going to run. It's Bernie, and she knows it. But with that being said, she's also not going to close the door to potentially being his VP pick. And let me just say this, even if I was previously hurt by what Elizabeth Warren did and disenfranchised by what she did and just honestly cringed at some of the stuff that she said in defense of her neoliberal allies in Congress, I would still absolutely support a Sanders-Warren ticket. I think that that would be huge, not just for progressive policies, but in terms of the electoral success that that ticket would have. I mean, you have two people who are, for the most part, unapologetically progressive. Certainly, Bernie Sanders is better than Elizabeth Warren. Neither of them are perfect, but I mean, it would be a substantial improvement. It'd be probably the best ticket we've seen since Jimmy Carter, perhaps even since FDR in terms of economic populism. So if she wants to be vice president, I support that 100%, even if I do feel disappointed in what she previously did, or more specifically didn't do in choosing to not endorse Bernie. But I can get over that if we're going to get the policy concessions that that we've all been fighting for. So, you know, only time will tell, but hopefully her message does resonate about us not only being the party that pays attention once every 4 years. And I totally get the irony in me discussing this and pretty much contradicting the importance of that point. But I do think that, you know, even though I don't want to get bogged down by presidential politics, progressives, we were fucked over last time. So we do have to become hypersensitive to any and everything the establishment might try to pull. But at the same time, we have to commit to still fight when there are years of midterms and years when there's no presidential election. So yeah. So after months of Donald Trump saber-rattling against Kim Jong-un in North Korea, after Kim Jong-un threatening the United States over and over, finally it seems as though there's a glimmer of hope that these two man-babies will come together and work out a solution face-to-face, because Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un have in fact planned a meeting. Now this would be something that is absolutely historic. To have the United States president meet with the leader of North Korea, I mean, that's huge, right? Am I confident that this meeting will go well? No, not at all. It could backfire, but at the same time, it could work, because Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, I mean, I feel like they're kind of cut from the same cloth. They were both raised with silver spoons in their mouths. They're both egotistical, narcissistic, megalomaniacal, both rich. So I think maybe if they got together, that would humanize the other, and maybe they could come up with some sort of solution. I don't know. But certainly the fact that they're even attempting diplomacy or even talking about diplomacy to me is pleasantly surprising. However, someone who is supposedly a liberal, Rachel Maddow, you'd think would be in favor of them trying diplomacy at least, but recently on her show, she scoffed at the idea of Donald Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un.
Trump and Kim Jong-un meeting personally and directly, according to tonight's announcement, and planning to do so, reportedly, just a few weeks from now. Now, you might imagine another president in this circumstance. Kim Jong-un makes a request. Do you want to meet? You might think like another president in this circumstance, you could imagine a president asking himself or herself, why has no other American president ever agreed to do this? Why has no sitting American president ever met with a leader from North Korea? Why has that never happened in all the decades North Korea has existed as a nation? Why hasn't any other president ever done? Should I take that to mean that this might be a particularly risky or even an unwise move? See, I think that's how most presidents would approach the idea of a personal presidential meeting with the North Korean dictator. I think a lot of people probably suspect tonight that those are not the kinds of questions that this president asked himself before agreeing to this meeting. But this is the president we have, and he said yes to North Korea.
Okay, look, I get it. I, too, don't know if this meeting will go well. But what's the alternative, Rachel? Should they continue trading insults back and forth with one another as the world watches in terror, as people in South Korea wonder if they're going to be bombed, as Japan worries if there's going to be a missile headed their way? I mean, what's the alternative? Diplomacy should be the only solution, because diplomacy is a deterrent from war. So the fact that you're scoffing at the idea and condescendingly suggesting that Donald Trump is wrong here because other presidents didn't do it, well, so what? See, here's my question. Would Rachel Maddow be saying the same exact thing if it were President Obama who agreed to meet with Kim Jong-un? I don't think so, because when President Obama restored diplomatic relations between the United States and Cuba, she didn't scoff at the idea of diplomacy then. This was in 2014. She didn't suggest that Obama shouldn't do it because his predecessors didn't do it. In fact, this is what she had to say about it.
That is at the heart of this absolutely epic surprise announcement made by the President of the United States today. I mean, there had been signs that something was going to happen, that maybe something was going on. Little signs. Tony Blinken, this guy, when he was up for confirmation for the senior State Department job, which he just got confirmed for this week, one of the things he got asked about at his confirmation hearing was about the chatter in Washington that something was about to happen on the issue of Cuba. Yesterday, we're told there was the first direct contact between an American president and a Cuban leader since the 1959 revolution that brought Fidel Castro to power. Raul Castro spoke directly with President Obama on the phone yesterday, we're told, for about 45 minutes. They talked directly. That itself is historic. The United States cut off diplomatic relations with Cuba in 1961. Today, our diplomatic relations were restored by order of President of the United States. The United States will now move to open an embassy in Cuba for the first time since the Eisenhower administration. Cuba will open an embassy here. Travel restrictions will be somewhat relaxed. Cuban Americans will be able to send more money home. Our government and the Cuban government will start taking on, talking about a host of diplomatic issues, including terrorism and whether or not Cuba should be kept on the list of state sponsors of terror.
So after seeing that, I'm convinced 100% that Rachel Maddow is nothing more than a hack. As if I needed more evidence, right? Because how is it that she described Obama's decision to unilaterally restore diplomatic ties between the U.S. and Cuba? She said it was, quote, absolutely epic.
Absolutely
epic. She didn't suggest in that segment that since the last 10 presidents hadn't spoken with a Cuban dictator, that maybe it's not a good idea for Obama to do it. Now, I get it, North Korea and Cuba are different cases, but the idea of diplomacy in general is something that liberals of all stripes should theoretically be championing, since, again, it's a deterrent for war. But when Trump tries it, all of a sudden Rachel Maddow scoffs at the idea of diplomacy, but when Obama does it, she praises him for it and says that it's epic.
Absolutely epic.
So the obvious conclusion is that she's a hack. She's not against diplomacy because she is taking a principled stance against diplomacy. She is only against Donald Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un because Donald Trump is the one meeting with Kim Jong-un. If it were Obama, she would be praising him and she'd call it absolutely epic, I bet.
Absolutely epic.
She's basically taken this anti-Trump stance and she's agreed as a propagandist for the Democratic Party to just be opposed to everything that Donald Trump does ever. That's why scoffing at the idea of diplomacy with North Korea was her default position. She probably didn't even think about it. Now, I'm not suggesting that Donald Trump is a genius or a saint for suggesting this or going along with an invite to meet with Kim Jong-un. But what I am saying is that objectivity matters, especially in journalism. You shouldn't just be against something because Donald Trump is the one that did it. If he is able to succeed here and get peace with North Korea and strike a long-term solution, then you should be in favor of it in the same way that Republicans should be in favor of Obama's Iranian nuclear deal, which stopped them from getting a nuclear weapon. Not that they wanted it in the first place, but the fact that this was a deterrent and stopped neocons from being able to say that we should invade Iran was really important. So if Donald Trump does something that's beneficial for everyone, that promotes international peace and stability, then you should applaud him for it, not scoff at the idea of diplomacy, Rachel Maddow. But this is the way that she's been conducting herself since Donald Trump took office. I mean, she basically lost her mind. Now, of course, if you were to reverse this and Obama did in fact attempt diplomacy and to meet with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, then you could guarantee that there would be a lot of Republicans opposed to it just because Obama did it. The fact of the matter is that we need objectivity, but all we have are a bunch of partisan hacks in the mainstream media that are doing nothing more than propaganda for their respective parties. And, you know, you would expect better from the so-called liberal news outlet, that is mainstream media, and the so-called liberal news in general. But this is the best that we get. Hacks who denounce things that they theoretically should agree with and probably would agree with based on her history of being someone who doesn't necessarily advocate for war, who's taken anti-war stances in the past, but all of a sudden Rachel Maddow is a war hawk and MSNBC is a warmongering network if it means that they have an opportunity to oppose Trump and disagree with Donald Trump. Former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton was in India recently, and the subject of the 2016 presidential election came up for some reason. And even though she lost the easiest race imaginable to a reality television show star, she somehow found a way to be pretentious about her loss. Now, I'm not showing this clip to you or talking about this because I think Hillary Clinton was pretentious, but what she's saying here is incredibly problematic, and I think it's potentially harmful to the Democratic Party's chances in 2018 and even 2020 if this type of rhetoric catches on. So this is what she had to say, and then we'll talk about it after I show you the clip.
If you look at the map of the United States, there's all that red in the middle where Trump won. I win the coasts, I win, you know, Illinois and Minnesota, places like that. But what the map doesn't show you is that I won the places that represent two-thirds of America's gross domestic product. So I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward, and his whole campaign, Make America Great Again, was looking backwards. You know, you didn't like black people getting rights, you don't like women, you know, getting jobs, you don't want to, you know, see that Indian American succeeding more than you are. Whatever your problem is, I'm going to solve it.
She just can't let go of 2016. And this is what she said in particular that I took issue with. I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward, and his whole campaign, Make America Great Again, was looking backwards. You know, you didn't like black people getting rights. You don't like women getting jobs. You don't want to see that Indian American succeeding. So what's the underlying implication here with what she's saying? I won with the forward-thinking individuals, whereas Donald Trump only won with the inbred, backwards, racist people in the country. Now, is it true that backwards, immigrant-hating, racist people voted for Donald Trump? Absolutely, that's true. I think you can't deny that. But what she's suggesting here is that everyone who voted for Donald Trump was bad, and everyone who voted for her, by definition, they were good people. The implication is that people only voted for Donald Trump because of his racism, but I think that people probably voted for Donald Trump in spite of his racism and knowing that he's a nationalistic, xenophobic tribalist. But to suggest that they voted for him specifically because of his racism is an idea that will lose the Democratic Party seats. It's pretentious, it's condescending, and what she's failing to realize here is that voters, more so than anything, they're self-interested. So even if they know that Donald Trump has policies that will harm people they love, gay people, African Americans, they're still willing to suck it up and vote for him if they think there's going to be a net positive for them. So when Donald Trump said that he'd bring back coal jobs and manufacturing jobs in the Rust Belt, people might have disagreed with his social policy, but voted for him strictly based on the populist economic message that he was championing. Now, I'll admit, I was personally offended by people who I knew and were friends with that did tell me they were voting for Donald Trump, because I thought, how could you vote for someone who you know will hurt me as someone who is gay, who wants to take my rights away? And what I realized overall was that people weren't necessarily thinking about the net negatives they were thinking about the positives that would specifically benefit their lives. Because at the end of the day, people are self-interested and we care more about ourselves than others. So even if, you know, my brother voted for Donald Trump knowing that he has a vice president that would want to take away my rights, if he thinks that would help him financially, if he thinks Donald Trump would increase his wages somehow or give him a tax break, he voted for him anyway. He didn't vote for Donald Trump because of his homophobia. He voted for Donald Trump in spite of his homophobia. And this doesn't characterize every single Donald Trump supporter, but I think the important thing to realize here is that people are complex beings. There's nuance. You can't just paint all of Donald Trump supporters with a broad brush because nobody likes to be generalized. And that's not a very good strategy. If you honestly want to win them over, you have to win them over by appealing to economic policy and things that will benefit them, not by just calling them racist, because what that does is piss people off. You're not going to attract people to the Democratic Party if you have a bunch of Democrats and neoliberals using this same type of rhetoric. If Democrats start adopting this line of thinking, then they will lose. You're isolating voters who were desperate, who were hurting and wanted economic relief, and just thought that Donald Trump would be the one to give it to them. Now, are they still wrong for voting for Donald Trump? Absolutely, because I think there were a lot of signs that Donald Trump was full of shit and that he was a fake populist. I had no faith whatsoever that he would be a non-interventionist. I had no faith whatsoever that he would be an economic populist, despite what he said on the campaign trail. I knew that he probably would still try to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, even if he said he would protect those things. But people were willing to latch on to anything because they were desperate. They were struggling. Now, again, I never advocated for anyone to vote for Donald Trump, but I do think that it's harmful to just say that they were all racist. That's what Hillary Clinton is doing here. It's intellectually lazy, and most importantly, it's very harmful to the Democratic Party's electoral prospects. Now, I can't get excited with the idea of Democrats taking back Congress because they're not offering a vision that is an alternative, better vision to what the Republican Party is offering, but it's still preferable if Democrats win because they at least wouldn't take us backwards. We may remain static, but we're certainly not regressing in terms of what we've done in this country to fix some of the issues that have been plaguing the country forever. So I don't think Hillary Clinton will ever get it. She just never will get it. She's an out-of-touch oligarch who loves the smell of her own farts and is just saying what she wants to hear, not what's the truth. So I just felt the need to come out and denounce what she's saying again, because I don't want people to think what she's saying is true. Because if you start generalizing an entire group of voters, basically half the country who voted for Donald Trump, you're not going to change any minds that way. It's just, it's problematic. I don't get what she's doing here. I think that it's destructive and she needs to stop. Well, that's all I got for you guys today. As usual, I want to send a huge shout out to all of our Patreon and PayPal contributors, and also to our GoFundMe backers who are helping us pay for this brand new studio that I am now sitting in that I cannot wait to reveal. Hopefully you guys enjoyed the episode because it was difficult. It's getting a little bit cramped in here because I'm kind of boxing myself into a corner to film now until the studio is finished. So, you know, hopefully the show was enjoyable, even if it wasn't perfect, but, you know, we're doing what we can. So thank you all so much if you made it this far in the episode. I will see you all next week. Take care.